All right. So welcome, everybody, to the Value Add Strategy Podcast, where we inspire entrepreneurs through real life stories. I'm here to welcome my good friend and colleague and broker that I've worked with for a number of years in the manufactured housing space, Michael DeSillo. So, Michael, I really appreciate you being here with us today.
Yeah, Matt, excited to talk with you today, as always. Love working with you over the years, and excited to share a little bit of that journey with your audience here today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're going to be really excited and hopefully inspired. No doubt I've been over the years since I've known you. So we're really excited to have you. So with that, why don't we start just kind of getting an idea of your background, where you're from, you know, where you grew up, you know, kind of what your upbringing was like, and then what initially attracted you into the manufactured housing space. I don't think any of us, you know, going back into grade school when we were asked what we wanted to be when we grew up, a manufactured housing industry professional would have been the answer. It certainly wasn't mine. Maybe it was yours. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I missed that answer in fifth grade when they asked you what you wanted to be. Football player was always my thing. And, kind of was part of my upbringing, Cleveland, Ohio, blue collar family, and football was sort of life. Ended up playing Division III football at John Carroll University here in Cleveland, Ohio. Was set back by an injury. Ended up getting into boxing. Did some Golden Gloves coming out of college, but yeah, it was, you know, through all that hard work and discipline, just training, being regimented, being a part of the team, you know, really kept you focused. And yet, it's sort of a corollary to what we do today, right? In real estate, it's just moment by moment, play by play, each rep, each workout. It's like what we do. It's deal by deal where, you know, Crystal View is this $500+ million fund, right? But you started at one point and you're at this new point, and that's all you have right now. Of course, you want to grow it. I'm sure you're going to have plans to grow it double, triple. But all we can do is the deals that are in front of us, the phone calls that are in front of us, the person that's in front of us. So that was a really good time in my life to build those habits of just, you know, shaking off the result, whether it be good or bad, obviously celebrating the wins, learning from the losses, but continuing to move on and just, not to sound cliche, but enjoying the process. And that's a lot of what we do, right? It's, you never feel like you've done enough and you always feel like you have more to do. But all you can do is right now and what's in front of you. So real estate in my early 20s was just something I wanted to get into. I was very curious. I saw what it could bring in terms of income generation, wealth, freedom. And, you know, I was a finance major at John Carroll, but I really thought some of the benefits of real estate, whether it be the cash flow, the tax benefits, you know, you study finance, you study so much about stocks and equities and, you know, with real estate, you actually can like physically see it, touch it, feel it, which is, you know, real. Yeah, which is great. And whether it's investing in a vehicle like CVC or, you know, buying your own rental property, you know, the operator, you know, all the business operations, you can really touch it, feel it, which to me was way more appealing.
We call it control your own destiny here at Crystal View.
Yeah. Yeah, really. So I just feel like there's so many opportunities. And at first I thought maybe it was going to be a single family residential broker. I had tried a variety of things, flip, you know, worked with some guys who did some flips, analyzing potential flip opportunities. But I had a really good friend. I suggest I talk to two guys who were running a mobile home park team out of Cleveland, Ohio, and John McClellan, Kyle Baskin, my current day partners. And, they were looking to grow their team and gave me an opportunity. And, you know, the rest was history. Now we can talk about how we went from there to 9 years later. But, you know, they basically said, you got a desk, go get a real estate license. And my family and friends all just kind of said to me, well, when this doesn't work out, can you still sell like normal real estate? And, you know, some people today, I think, no matter how many times I tell them, they probably still don't know what I do or understand mobile home parks, and that's okay. But yeah, that was it. They're just like, I hope this works out for you. And it's worked out great.
Yeah. It's an unbelievable industry and it's a great story. You know, I always joke when I started back in the industry, and what year did you start, by the way, in manufactured housing?
2016.
Okay. So I bought my first park in 07. And, you know how we acquire deals. It's the same way I bought them for myself. Back in the beginning, it was just picking up the phone and talking to these mom and pop owners. And I remember telling people, I always kind of made the analogy, when you went to cocktail parties back in 07, 08, 09, and you said, hey, you know, I buy mobile home parks. You just got like this weird look. And they were just a lot of confusion. Why would you do such a thing? Doesn't make much sense. I've never heard that before. Well, fast forward to today, you go to a cocktail party. Everybody says, wow, I've heard those are cash cows. A lot more, it's become more institutionalized, if you will, you know, back then. And it's still an asset class that's predominantly owned and operated by mom and pops. I would say way more than 50% are, but back then it was probably more along the lines of 80%. And you know, over time, I think that percentage is going to go down and down. But when you first started back in 16, as compared to today, and I know you're very aggressive on the phone and you guys have a great outreach to owners, where do you see the difference between mom and pop ownership back in 16 compared to 9, 10 years later in 25 in terms of those conversations?
Yeah, man, I think your story about cocktail hour and how that's evolved, it's kind of a good parallel to our industry. I think we've evolved as an industry. It went from this kind of stepchild persona to now maybe more of a public darling. When you see some of the private equities and some of the institutional capital that's flowing into our space, I think it really speaks to the evolution of our industry. And so to your point, and to your question directly, these owners have grown up and matured with us as an industry and as an asset class. They've become more educated. And I think whether good or bad, I think brokers like myself and when you start having principals that either go direct principal to principal, whether it be mom and pop or institution to institution, we all start to have this collective understanding of our asset class. And I think we've done whether you think the outcome is good or bad, I think we've just done a good job of educating people on what they have, what the asset is, what it's worth, what it is, what it isn't, because there's been so many more conversations, because there's been so much more attention, whether it be publicity through media news outlets or one-to-one conversations, whether it be going to the conferences, which have continued to grow and become more robust. So we've grown up as an asset class. It's become more efficient than, you know, say our retail and multifamily brothers and sisters. But we've grown up, and it's, I think it's an exciting thing to be a part of. It's an exciting asset class to, you know, your background coming in 06, man, you know, it makes me look like, a baby. And I know there's others that have come before us, whether it be, you know, my business partners or others of my firm that, you know, there was no asset class, so to speak, of John McClellan, my senior partner. I mean, he was supposed to, you know, sell mobile home parks, and nobody had sold a mobile home park in our office. And they just said, go figure it out, you know, and he's driving around the Midwest, park to park and, you know, trying to figure it out. And, you know, to his credit, figured it out. And I'm grateful he did, because I built a career off of that hard work. And, you know, as an entrepreneurial podcast, I think it's important to talk about the resilience and where people started. You in 06, like, what was that like buying that park? You didn't know. I mean, I'm sure you had visions and goals just knowing you, but you didn't know where you were going. And I know John McClellan didn't know he'd build a, you know, $8+ billion manufactured housing team across the country. But, you know, it's people like you and like John who had that, you know, intestinal fortitude and resilience through downturns to persist. So,
well, you got to believe in yourself and what you're doing. I'm sure you would echo what I'm about to say, but I don't believe in another asset class quite like this one. I think just the long-term viability is stronger here than any of the other commercial real estate asset classes. And if I were to put my own money, which I do, into real estate, it would be heavily weighted into this asset class, provided you've got a good operator, you've got a disciplined approach, and you know how to manage effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, The one thing that we have going for us in terms of creating value and building wealth in the asset class is that as we've matured, the one thing we don't have that other asset classes have is, you know, in multifamily, you have multifamily developers that come in, they build it, they infill, they stabilize, and then they flip out to long-term owner operators. You know, we can unpack the nuances of building new parks and why it's actually, you know, so prohibitive, and we're probably net losing parks year over year. But we've never been able to have that mobile home park developer that's going across the country in major metros building new mobile home parks. So sad in the sense that we're not getting new inventory, but exciting in the sense that if you do own one of these assets, you're holding on to, you know, a really strained supply and what's going to, again, in my opinion, and maybe you could weigh in on this, but
yeah,
you know, we're not going to have more parks in 10 years than we do today. I think we're going to definitely have less.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the supply and demand characteristics are more compelling here than anywhere. I mean, this is probably the only, other than office, which, I mean, is almost effectively dead, this may be the only commercial real estate asset class where your supply is shrinking. But unlike office, where demand is also shrinking, demand for this asset class is off the charts. So it's really incredible when you've got shrinking supply and exploding demand, and it translates into tremendous pricing power as an operator.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you study the spreads on the cost of living for median household price versus a two-bedroom apartment versus the cost to own and pay rent in a mobile home park, I mean, the deltas are seismic. I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, anywhere from 3, 4, 5 up to 700% in certain markets. I mean, when we talk about affordable housing, I mean, those metrics really speak to the mission that mobile home parks across the country provide. You know, I don't know another product type that's really serving a huge need like that. You know, it's also exciting to be a part of, you know, like something that's really mission critical to our country, to our communities, you know. And I've been through a handful of years, and there's a lot of great, you know, really, if people take the time to, instead of just driving by them, drive through a park and really check it out. I mean, there's some really, really high-end communities. And, you know, think of that guy on Google Maps when you drop him in and you look around. I mean, there's some communities you get dropped in the middle of, you would not know you're in a manufactured housing community. It looks very much feels, and in some senses, like, exactly.
Yeah, you know, I will say we've had a bad stigma, this asset class, for a number of years, and I hope that it's dissipating. You know, back to that cocktail party back in 06, the immediate thought is, oh, trailer trash, and, you know, these are tin cans, and there's a guy with a ripped t-shirt drinking a Budweiser standing in front of his homes. But to your point, you know, when you drive through these communities and you see the pride of ownership, and you mentioned mission critical, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, a huge segment of our population is being displaced where they just can't afford housing for their family. So it's extremely satisfying to fill that niche, to fill that need and demand, to buy homes, bring them into your community, repave the roads, create that pride of ownership, allow these folks to own a piece of the American dream. Unlike multifamily, they actually own their home. While it might sit on our lot and they may pay us lot rent, they're still building equity. When they go to sell that home years down the road, you know, as opposed to moving out of an apartment complex and just kind of throwing away that rent, here they're actually going to be able to profit in a lot of instances from the ownership of that home. So it's really satisfying. And if it's done right, it's a win-win because it's satisfying and it's profitable. But that stigma of trailer trash, I think, is leaving the industry. And a lot, what we're seeing in our communities anyway, a lot more folks are willing and really want to come into our communities and be homeowners. And I'm sure you're seeing that across, you know, the listings that you have and your other clients.
Yeah. And you used a key word there, their communities, and whether it be through amenities or just the socialization of neighbors who are of like mind. I mean, really, yeah, really and truly building communities, places you want to call home. So
sure.
Good to be a part of that mission for sure.
Yeah, it is. I want to bring up something with your partners, I think is important and noteworthy with Jonathan McClellan and Kyle Baskin. Great guys. We've all done business several times over the years with Crystal View, both on the buy side and sell side. I think you guys are some of the best in the industry. But to put things into perspective for our listeners, how collectively in transaction volume, you guys have done a tremendous number of deals. And you know, from a dollar standpoint, what kind of transactions have you been involved in over the years in this industry?
Yeah, so like you touched on, John McClellan and Kyle Baskin, they've, as a team, since their inception, been a part of $8.5 billion in manufactured housing communities, well over 750 communities nationwide. As I mentioned, I came in 16, and I've had the pleasure of being a part of just over $5 billion worth of transactions. And that involves $540 million last year, $1.3 billion in 2023. Currently, we've got $448 million in escrow and $492 million in listings. So a lot of sales volume. And, you know, I know this is an entrepreneurial podcast and talking about partners, and I'm sure there's people in different phases of their life cycle and careers. What drew me to these guys was the volume and the activity. Coming into a new space, a new business, I had gotten some really great advice from a residential broker, and he just said, listen, whatever you do, get a part of a big team. You want to be around a lot of transactions. That was the single, it was a residential guy. I thought I wanted to be a part of residential. And I just looked him up. I cold called him. I'm like, listen, can I get 15 minutes of your time? I'll buy a cup of coffee, whatever. I just need to like know what you know, or at least point me in the right direction. And the thing that I really walked away with was, you know, be a part of a big team. Don't be this lone ranger out of the gates because you want to make all the money and not have the splits, et cetera. You want to be around volume, want to be around activity, people who do deals. And John McCullen and Kyle Baskin were two guys who did a lot of deals. And, you know, at first I wasn't a part of a lot of those. I had to, you know, carry my own water, so to speak, for a while there. You know, I was every day watching them in the office and hearing them and having calls with them. And you start to just pick things up and you start to learn. And wherever you are in business or in industry or sales, you know, get around people who are doing what you want to do. And, you know, to me, I think some of the giving up some opportunity, you know, upside to be around and expose yourself, I think is really valuable, because long term it sets you up to have had, you know, the success that I've been fortunate enough to have, because I started with people who did a lot of deals. And then eventually I became a part of a lot of deals. And that's just advice I'd give to anybody.
I think it's a great piece of advice. And I think it just ties back into choosing the right partners and the right mentors, whatever business that you want to go in. And you've been fortunate in doing both, it sounds like, with Kyle and Jonathan, and your experience with Marcus and Millichap.
Yeah, and Marcus and Millichap too, I just want to touch on, is they have a really strong track record of success. And the people that have been at the firm, it was really exciting and motivating to me to show up and see people have been there 10, 15 years and see where they're at in their careers, and see that they started in a bullpen, probably right where you're sitting. And, you know, the proof is all around you. You just need to look, and you want to make sure you're in those situations where there is success. And, you know, I was fortunate, and I still feel fortunate to be a part of this firm, to be a part of my team. But whether you stay where you start, or you end up going off and doing something different or going off on your own, I think you need to start in a culture of winning and success. And Marcus and Millichap in the manufactured housing division there was, you know, my manager and the head of manufactured housing, Michael Glass. And, you know, he had started, you know, the office and the division himself, and, you know, just really grew it. And so you just see all these people, whether it be multifamily, apartment broker, or apartments, retail, hotels, industrial, and then manufactured housing. See all these people had grown with the firm and built their careers. And that's the type of place that you want to start if you're just getting started.
Yeah.
And Matt, I know this is a, you know, you're interviewing me, but I'm just kind of curious. I don't know this about you. You talk about mentors and people that may be partners. Like, who were some of your first mentors and advisors or partners that got you going? I mean, I know you've got a tremendous work ethic and you're a grinder, but I mean, was there anybody there to kind of put some guardrails on young Matt and get him going in the right direction?
Well, I was going to say maybe unfortunately or fortunately, I didn't have many guardrails. You know, I got started in, I'm from a sales background like yourself, and I got started as kind of like that lone wolf, lone ranger. I was in residential sales.
Okay.
And I just loved the idea of getting on the phone, and I saw the value in it, you know, in terms of picking up the phone and building your business. It came back to relationships at the end of the day. Yeah. I mean, the reason we're here today on this podcast is because of relationships. And the only way to build it is, I'm going to go back to something you said, is discipline. You know, your experience as a football player and doing the reps and grinding it out day by day. You know, I was an athlete as well when I was younger. And, you know, I was big in exercise, lifting weights, and that discipline to me was second nature. So what people shied away from, I thought this is going to be my strength because they shy away from hard work. I love hard work. I look forward to working hard because I know that's where all the fruit is. So, you know, I took those habits, those discipline, and really applied them to real estate. But I'll tell you, a mentor, to answer the other part of your question there, was actually a guy in Cleveland, Ohio. Back in 2006, I met a guy at a wealth expo by the name of Scott Scheel. And I don't know if you know that name, but he had a program, and he's still active today, Commercial Property Academy. And he really taught the ins and outs of commercial real estate. You know, at the beginning, I had no clue. I knew how to sell. I knew how to get on the phone, but I didn't understand how to underwrite a deal, what a cap rate was, how you create value. And he really broke it down into simplistic terms. So that helped tremendously in terms of my education process of how to create value and how to underwrite, how to identify an opportunity and weed that out. Partly, I think it's instinctual. You could just, some people pick up on value very quickly. Others, they could be exposed to it and they just can't see it. And they're very intelligent. It's not a matter of intelligence. Some of this is innate. So, you know, I took what I learned. Luckily, I had some innate skill and ability to really sniff out value and really applied that. And then I kind of gravitated to this manufactured housing asset class because I liked the grimy aspect to it. I liked the whole trailer aspect. And I like the idea of people kind of shying away from something because in my mind, it means less competition. So I took my sales skills, my ability to underwrite, and then this kind of grimy asset class and melded them all together. And here we are in mobile home communities today. So that's just a little feel for my background. And hopefully that answers your question.
Well, that's awesome. I didn't know that about you, but everything starts and stops in Cleveland, huh?
Yeah, I mean, Cleveland's a great city. I spent some time out there, and you got a great Little Italy, by the way. I know you're Italian. Any favorite restaurants in that area?
I mean, Maxie's is the go-to down in Little Italy for sure. Anytime you're in town, Maxie's is the spot in Little Italy for sure.
I'll have to hit that up the next time I'm there. Yeah, or we'll grab dinner together. I know you spend half of your time in Miami or in South Florida, right?
Yeah, Palm Beach is my other home half the year, and also a great spot, and a lot of good restaurants and a good scene there as well.
And you're married and three children, right? Two girls and a boy?
You got it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What advice would you give your children today if they were thinking of becoming an entrepreneur?
I mean, I think I would take the same advice I just kind of shared with everybody, not to be redundant or repetitive, but I think you want to get around people that are doing what you want to do. I mean, I tell my kids not this now. My oldest is just started working for the first time. And, you know, I really encourage my kids and all my kids is just get around people that do what you want to do. Get, you know, as a young person, we lack knowledge, but you have time. And so I encourage them that, you know, give up your time to get around somebody that can teach you something. And, you know, you ask about my family, and my wife's actually a really great example of this. And she's a, whatever success or version of success maybe people perceive I've had, my wife's had like astronomically more, exponentially more success than me. She sold single family homes coming out of college, and she was really successful, top agent, top earner. But she found this woman who had a home healthcare business. And so She would sell homes, and then she shadowed this woman for a year. She got her coffee, made her copies, whatever she needed, she shadowed this woman for a year. And then my wife, you know, was making really good money and decides, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. I'm going to start my own home healthcare business. And so she was employee one of one and for 4 years. So this is talking about, and you're talking about like hands-on, she would, it's assisted daily living. So you need to help someone dress, hygiene. So that's bathing, medicines, doctor's appointments, eating, sleep, et cetera. So she's caring for people in their homes. And after 4 years, she was finally able to hire her first employee. And now fast forward 15 plus years, she's over 100 employees. She has 75 clients. And, you know, where it started was she gave up her time to learn about a business and get into an industry. And so many people see, you know, Matt Riccadella has done so well, is on Fund 4, you know, all these assets, 500 million assets under management, but started in 06 with a, you know, 30 site mobile home park, right? And my wife, you know, you look at her and she's the epitome of success. She's so humble. She works every single day, gets dressed, goes to an office, is in the field 24/7. But it started with giving up her time, and you don't see all those years in her 20s when she gave up part of her social and fun time to basically like be her own employee. And nobody told her, hey, if you just stick with this, you'll create this budding enterprise and business. There was no promises, no guarantees, but she just hung in there, stuck with it. And now, I mean, just to again, just kind of give her credit, she's now started her own cybersecurity company, protecting personal and business endpoint users from cyber attacks. And she's built out this amazingly robust proprietary Google Chrome add-in. It's sort of a Swiss Army knife of plugins for Chrome. So she just keeps going. So I guess that's a long-winded way. And she's a great example to my kids. The best thing I tell my kids I ever did was choose her as their mother. So, but you know, she, you know, I think just giving up your time, I think, and getting around people that do what you want to do is really critical to achieving success. I think you can definitely learn a lot on your own, but I really think, you know, giving up some of your, I think a lot of people, young people especially, come out with these illusions of like making all this money right away, which is awesome. I would never discourage that. But I think if you can, I don't even know if my 20-year-old brain could have wrapped my head around this, but if somebody would have encouraged me, maybe I would have tried it. But, you know, not being so focused on income, being more focused around getting around the right people, getting in the right vehicle, whether it's sales, whether it's healthcare, whatever it is that you want to do, but like getting in the right lane. And then once you understand it, then applying pressure and time and speed, and then you can really accelerate. I think going it alone is not the most optimal path.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, and it's interesting. I've got two younger children myself, one a teenager and one's 11. But, you know, I think kids these days are jaded a bit by social media and instant gratification. You mentioned something I think is extremely important in your background, but you spoke very nicely about your wife in terms of her discipline, her sacrifice, and her time, giving up her fun time, right, to build her business. I mean, you look at an entrepreneur and you just look at the end result and it looks glitzy and it looks glamorous, but seldom do people really peel back the onion layer and say, what did this person put into being in this position today? When they see that, some of them shy away from that. Others embrace it, you know, and I think that's the big difference here in what we do. I mean, you've got to make a ton of sacrifices. You got to have that discipline. You got to grind it out, and you don't know the outcome. That's what makes a lot of this challenging, but I'd say that's what also makes it a lot of fun. If you knew what the outcome was, would you do it? You know, would you do it as passionately as we're doing it today? But I think that's a big lesson learned, especially for the younger generation. You know, you gotta roll up your sleeves a little bit. And the things that you see on social media, it doesn't work that way necessarily. It can. It didn't work that way for me anyway. And it sounds like it didn't work that way for you nor your wife. You got to really be willing to put in the work, and that's okay. And if you're taking time away from your friends or you're making sacrifices, if you're really passionate about it in the long run, it's all going to be worth it. And sometimes that joy is more in the pursuit of what you're looking to achieve than the end product itself. And I certainly feel like it shaped my character and who I am going through those tough times and grinding it out and having that discipline rather than, oh, you have 500 million of AUM. You don't really even stop and think about these things. You've become kind of a new person almost because of what you've put yourself through. And I think the goal for me anyway is to keep going, you know, not to stop once you achieve a certain outcome, but to keep seeing what's possible and keep putting yourself in a pressure cooker and becoming more of who you can be.
Yeah. So, I mean, that healthy competition with yourself, you know, I think sometimes just trying to do better than you did yesterday, incrementally, just improving, just sticking to a process, whatever it is, whether it's finding deals, managing and operating deals, managing and operating home healthcare business or cybersecurity company, just sticking to a process and enjoying that process. Because like you said, I mean, the outcome is maybe one day you hit your goal, but then there's a day after you hit your goal. Like, so yeah. Then what? And so then you're falling back to what I feel like is your processes and just never getting too high, never getting too low. I mean, listen, I know from your competitive background and knowing you, we hate losing, right? And the losses really probably stick a little bit harder for me personally. I don't want to speak for you, but you know, the losses really stick, but you know, you have to be able to get over those things and move on quickly and just, okay, what do I need to do now? What's important now, whether it be in my family, whether it be in my work, in my job, what's important right now? Because you're not the past and you're not the future. You're only what's, you know, literally this interview, this is what's important right now. There's nothing more beyond this than we can control. And after this, we'll get back to our next task. But for now, this is all we've got. So being process oriented is huge.
Yeah. And having that focus, you kind of shun everything else out. We're focused on this right now. And when we conclude this, I'm sure we'll be focused on a deal or something else. And then you give that your undivided attention. And then you get home at night after putting in a hard day's work and you focused on your wife and kids and you give them the attention they deserve. That's easier said than done, but I think that's a great takeaway for people. That focus is huge and critical to your success. I wanted to just touch on a moment that $8.5 billion of transaction volume. I know, you know, kind of go back to 21, maybe early part of 22. I'm sure that volume was more robust than it is perhaps today. Can you kind of just put things into perspective, like, how are deals trading compared to they were in the heyday when interest rates were 3%? Why do interest rates matter in terms of deal volume and cap rates? And why were there more buyers out in the game back then as compared to today?
Sure. Well, let me try to unpack it here. I mean, I think that just to paint an overarching picture, there's really a bifurcation in the market today as it relates to 21 and 22. I mean, institutional investors are still aggressively pursuing stabilized, high occupied, tenant owned communities in great locations. And I think what I mean by great location is not just geographically, but landlord friendly, market rent states and cities. So those are key. And specifically in markets in the West and in the Sun Belt, private owners are holding quality assets, but under optimized, especially in the Midwest, you know, and creating value in different ways. And maybe it's driving NOI through rent increases, utility recapture, or, you know, infill. But there's really a bifurcation between that institutional capital and what I'd say, you know, private owners looking elsewhere for value add. And he talked about interest rates. And I mean, really, that is the biggest driver of where we are today versus, again, 21 and 22, the 10 years, you know, hovering around 4.45. You know, that's a big driver. And once rates had gone up, what I've seen and observed from buyers is in 21 and 22, people really made sense of everything and anything. And then we were going to figure it out later because we had been in this period of rates just keep coming down and down and down, and we'll just keep raising rents and we'll just create all this value. I don't want to say it was artificial because at some point you could have realized your gain and materialized the gain. But if you didn't, you know, and now rates are up, and if you had a floater rate and
couldn't be running,
Yeah, I mean, there could be some, and where I see the shift is now, we can't just bank on lower rates. We can't just bank on rent increases, and we need to focus on operations. So groups that are focused on operating, and truly running a home sale program and infilling a community, truly redoing infrastructure, clubhouse amenities, creating value in different ways other than just kind of timing the market. We actually have to be, as a whole, as a market, as an industry, we have to be more operationally efficient. So that has really, what I feel like, reined in underwriting, and as a consequence, cap rates have gone up accordingly because we have to allow for upside and opportunity, whereas when money was cheap, we just felt like, okay, we'll just kick it down the road. What we're going to make money, rates are going to drop, rents are going to go up, things are going to be good here. And for a while they were.
So, I think there's a lot here, and it's obviously a very topical discussion in terms of our business and, the greater commercial real estate landscape at large. But I mean, back in 21, 22, you had all these buyers. I mean, and these cap rates were ridiculously low. And I think to your point, you brought up an important comment. I don't necessarily agree with, but I know this was the consensus amongst a lot of buyers, was we'll find a way to make it work. Just buy the thing. Rents are going to keep growing. So it's like, yeah, you could pull that lever. What happened? What other levers can you pull? Some of these groups, and maybe you could speak to this for a moment, like back in 21, 22, when we were in the heyday, there were a lot more groups. Perhaps you could speak to the sophistication of the operators and how deep the bench of these operators were, because I see a lot of these groups are now kind of sucking wind in the sense that they just bought it under the assumption that we're going to make it work no matter what. We raise rents. Maybe we lost some tenants, but we don't know what else to do. You brought up home sales. That's a huge undertaking. I could tell you we have a whole team at Crystalview that's dedicated to that effort, and it's fruitful. But you really got to put in the work. It's not like, hey, I sent out a rate increase and I created millions of dollars of value. I mean, we do a lot of that too. But in today's market, I could tell you what we're seeing, and I'd love to get your take. More than ever, you got to be more than a one-trick pony. Pulling the lever on the rate increase isn't going to cut it. You also have to know where to cut your costs, be conscious about billing back utilities. Where can you improve the pride of ownership? Where you could gain occupancy? Do you have the ability to buy homes in? Are you a dealer? Can you set homes up on the lot? Block level skirt, hook up utilities. Do you have a marketing campaign in place where you could sell those homes? Have you built up word of mouth, where residents will tell others outside the community to move in? This is a great place to live. Or do the residents despise you? Because I could see from some other operators, residents don't have a very good relationship, and therefore those operators have a harder time selling homes. So there's a lot that goes into this game. It's not just buying a park and jacking up rents, despite what
Sure.
perhaps some think, but maybe you could speak to that for a moment.
Yeah, I think what gets lost is, you get a headline, and I think there's a lot of clickbait out there, but there's some truth to it. But I think there's a lot more, really positive stories and people, communities being purchased, and a lot of money being reinvested in infrastructure, reinvested in amenities, roads, et cetera. Even just curb appeal. I mean, new signs in the front of a community. So I think, unfortunately for operators, most operators who are fallen in the bucket of successful and do well, their successes. I mean, nobody writes stories, or very rarely do you get a headline story of a positive success of a community turnaround. You don't see that. I mean, your investors see it when you buy it for X and raise the value, 33% in the first 2 years through your operational efficiencies. They hear those stories, but we don't hear about the market. The world doesn't hear about the success. We
We hear
hear about
about
the,
the
yeah.
media doesn't care, unfortunately. Maybe they should,
And maybe what we're doing here today is getting our axe out and grinding away at a little bit of that sentiment. But I could tell you, man, from my perspective, what the interest rates increasing and cap rates have gone up has really created is sort of this alternative investment bucket. Well, I touched on, that traditional buy box, that 200 plus site, private or public utilities, all tenant owned homes, amenitized, those communities are a few and far between. They're coveted. They're few and far between. And there's, just really cheap capital chasing it. So we can't get our hands on that. What else can we do? And what I've found is, and what's actually really amazing, we talk again about the maturity and the evolution of the manufactured housing communities asset classes. There's been some really creative people out there, and I want to touch on just a few just high level ideas.
Sure.
Number one is that buy box has always traditionally been, we only want public utilities. There's been groups that have said, when it comes to private utilities or, sewer systems, wells, whatever it might be, they said, if we can figure out these things and be the masters in them, we'll be the best in said state in these private utilities. They've just created a new buy box, where that private utility box would naturally eliminate a lot of groups and just be complete non-starters. You talked about, you want to be in places with less competition. Go into some of these places that are sort of non-starters, i.e. private utilities. All of a sudden, you look around the room and your competition is shrunk. So get comfortable with private utilities. There's also groups out there, park-owned homes. That's another one that, historically, the buy boxes, once we get above that Fannie and Freddie threshold of a percentage of park-owned homes to the total community, it's a non-starter. We don't want to deal with it. There's been groups that have now become sort of this subset of owners that said, we like the rental model. We understand it. We're going to get comfortable. We're going to be the park-owned home communities. We're looking for more than 50%, more than 70%. We want all rental communities. There's been creativity. Another one I'll tell you about is rent control. So
yeah,
and we can kind of jump into rent control if you want as a whole separate conversation. But
yeah, I think,
there's been, yeah, I mean, and it's really relevant to what's going on in the market. And again, that bifurcation of buyers right now, but there's groups that have really, rent control is a separate discussion, but it's there in certain markets, right? So how groups are dealing with rent control, whether it be looking through the ordinance and finding opportunities for pass-throughs, whether it be CapEx, utility pass-throughs, maybe looking for and petitioning for a fair market return. People have learned and studied those and become efficient with those. So that's another lever that, I'm seeing groups pull that are sort of creative and alternative. And, we did talk about rent control and, it's something I'm pretty passionate about just because it does, I feel like we're trying to create value in our industry for homeowners. And I think it actually creates the opposite for these folks.
Yeah.
You talked about people that buy a home in your community and you improve it and you move more homes in and the home price goes up. These rent control ordinances are not creating value for these residents long-term and short-sighted.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it de-incentivizes the ownership group to invest back into communities as well, because they're not realizing the revenue as a result of that investment because they're basically capped out. And I think, and I know you and I spoke about this, I think it's an interesting conversation in terms of states that are now enacting rent control. We talked about Oregon, which basically put in place, I believe, a 6% cap on any rate increases. Washington state just put in rent control. There's rumblings in Pennsylvania. You've got your states that have had rent control for years and years, New York, California. I think there's a few others. But you sell manufactured housing assets all throughout the U.S. I think you guys have probably sold them, I don't know, maybe in all 50 states at this point, or probably pretty close to it. Are you seeing a lot of investors fleeing those rent control states or those soon to be rent control states, going to the more red states that have a high likelihood of never bringing rent control into place?
Yeah, and that's really been a big driver in cap rates and pricing. I mean, if you look at, what some of these states and what the cap rates are going to because of imposed or, the looming of rent control, and you look at a free market rent state, I mean, we're talking, 300-400 basis point deltas here. I mean, it's not insignificant. Yeah, like you said, Oregon, the House Bill 354 passed in April. Washington went House Bill 1217 passed statewide, PA House Bill 914, which they introduced. But I think, you know, in California, again, has its sort of checkerboard. It could be city by city, county by county. You know, the ordinances are popping up all the time in different cities there. But, you know, if you look at Oregon and what they did a few years ago, they had gone to CPI plus 7% capped at 10. And everybody thought, well, great, they're allowing me a 10% rent increase by law. But I think what maybe people missed or maybe didn't, you know, scream and shout loud enough about was you just got comfortable. Like it's in act. It's enacted in law. We're operating under this rent control, even though it's high. We all would 10% is a healthy rent increase, but we got comfortable with this. And then next thing you know, you went from 10 and now we're ratcheted down to 6%. It's like, it's a very slippery slope once these things get passed into law. And even again, for PA, where it's the threat of rent control is looming, it's going to immediately seep into pricing into the market. I mean, Oregon, for what I would say the last 6 or 7 months while this bill has been floated, by and large, has sort of been a frozen market because people don't know what direction it's really going to go. I mean, the rent control that was proposed was actually more aggressive than what actually passed, but that threat really froze that market out. So I think that you're going to see that in Pennsylvania and anywhere else that there's that threat. Now, California, you know, I think people that want to own and operate there know it and are familiar with the ordinances and familiar with the politics in the state, but these other states are sort of new to the game. And I think it will follow with California. There'll just be certain groups that won't go. There are certain groups that will get comfortable with it and continue to own and operate. But again, you have to reevaluate your investment thesis. And a lot of groups, to your point, have. They're fleeing the blue states and looking for more traditionally red or, you know, likely to be red going forward states.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
Another cut you off. I mean, what, from your perspective at Crystal View, I mean, has your thought process changed or any of these measures, you know, kind of crept into your investment thesis and plans and goals going forward? And if so, how and what are you guys doing to adjust?
Yeah, well, great question. Obviously, it's crept in and you know, we've always been opportunistic here. So I would never say we're not going to buy in a state with rent control because historically we have and we'll continue to do so. But I think it all needs to be priced in. Right?
Yeah.
What is your value add if your ability to increase rents is taken away? Is it a great market to sell homes? You know, and what does that look like? And how does that deal underwrite? Can you still get comfortable with it? Can you buy it at a high enough yield with that upside to still hit your return metrics? If you can, I'd still buy in a rent control market. But, you know, you really got to thread that needle because, you know, if you make an error in maybe a red state and rents are really growing, that rate increase is going to solve all mistakes or heal all wounds. You know what I mean? So you can't really rely on that here. I will say that most of our acquisitions as of late have been in more reddish states. I mean, we've been very active in Iowa, which we like a lot. I mean, we've got a large deal. You and I were chatting about this the other day that's under contract in our Fund 4 at a very attractive basis. And, you know, we feel very comfortable with our ability to bring rents to a market level there. But to answer your question, at the end of the day, I think it all needs to be priced in conservatively into your underwriting. And if you can get comfortable after a conservative underwriting with the rent control, I would still move forward. But it's more challenging, as you know.
Yeah, and I think to your point, I think we're again, Washington, Oregon, and, you know, probably by extension, PAs are going to get hung up is that most people are going to have that approach, right? And specifically Washington, because they haven't had an ordinance prior and PA as well. You know, we talk about educating sellers and owners, right? Well, the education has been you're getting a cap rate that's commensurate with a free market rent community. There's going to be an adjustment. And I do think you look at velocities in all three of those states, Oregon, Washington, PA. And I think you're going to definitely see a dip in velocity for a while here until the pricing and markets can kind of balance out, because I think the delta between what bid to ask is going to be pretty large. Probably what you saw in early 2023 coming off of the period of low interest rates. You know, it took a while for for people to really adjust. And I think we're, you know, to be direct, I think we're still adjusting, because that low interest rate period, if you weren't, you know, forced to sell, you were educated by all these, I mean, these amazing, attractive, low cap rate, high dollar volume pricing. And even when you kept up with rent increases, I think in some states, in some markets, pricing's maybe starting to like level out or come back around to where it was dollar for dollar. But I just talked to somebody the other day, and the offer was on par with where they were years ago, but they were like, what's the cap rate? And the cap rate was, you know, 150 basis points up of where it was. And like, well, that other cap rate was really great. It's just like, I know it was really great, but it's not coming back, you know? So there, I think there definitely has been sort of a leveling off period and a recalibration between buyers and sellers in this current higher interest rate period that we're going through. And you and I were chatting yesterday, but you know, I think that there eventually will be an uptick in velocity, but I definitely think the velocity in transactions is significantly down, and I think much, much lower than it was a couple of years ago because of that reason, interest rates and cap rates being so far off of where they were at the peak.
Well, and I think expectations are off from sellers too. To your point, it's somebody called them 3 or 4 years ago, that offer is etched into their mind. While it's no longer reality, it's something with optics or psychology, they just can't let it go. You know,
sure.
Can't let go that somebody called them in 21 or 22 and offered them a 3.5 or a 4 cap, which was several million dollars more than what the asset's worth today. They have a hard time accepting that, but it's the cold, hard facts. I mean, you know, Microsoft stock perhaps years ago is more than it is today. I don't think it was, but the point of the matter is the market's no longer here. And it's hard for some folks to accept that. And then, you know, I own assets too. I wish I could get what I could get back in 21 or 22 on some of these. Luckily for us, we've really created a lot of value, and the asset is actually worth more despite a higher cap rate environment, because we've done to internally influence that asset value back to controlling your destiny. But I'm sure it's an interesting conversation, and one that you have all the time with these seller groups.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, managing expectations is critical across the board, whether it's buyers, sellers. It's just nature of the business that we're in.
So in terms of investing, I think it's a good segue. You know, you are at a unique position where you get to network with and have communications and dialogue with all types of investors, from institutional to PE firms to your first-time mobile home park investors. Perhaps you could just take a moment and talk about what characteristics, well, A, what makes a great mobile home community investor in your mind / operator? And what are the characteristics and traits that separate the best from those that aren't going to make it in this industry?
The first characteristic you're looking for is some type of proven track record of success, you know, being able to pull out a deal book and say, you know, here's our track record. We bought this asset for X. Here's the deal story. And just keep proof stacking all these different, you know, deals that you've created value. And I think that operational experience is really critical. I think the really great operators are busy operating their communities. They're actually, you know, boots on the ground, have actually been to the communities, visit them, know the people, know the managers, know the markets, know what's going on. They're hands-on, you know, and I know you at Crystal View, you guys are very hands-on. I've seen you, you know, out on the properties. I know that when we work on deals, you're on the next flight to you know, get on site. I think as much as
meeting with these owners before a deal goes under contract. Remember that deal in Michigan that we won, just getting face to face with these folks, you know, and build a relationship.
I think as soon as that door opened, I literally think you flew on the next flight out of Vegas. So, but I mean, that's really the difference in that, you know, that personal touch. I mean, you know, Matt, we're in the real estate business. Other people watching this are going to be in different service businesses or sales businesses or healthcare businesses, right? But I think overall, and I'll get back to your question, but I think overall, we're all in the people business.
Yeah.
And And as a broker, I'm in the people business and I'm in the information business. You know, what you want out of me is, you know, you want me to connect you with the right people to buy the right deals and vice versa. And you want information about the deals. You want information about the market. You want information about the trades that we've made relative to your assets and how, you know, how does it impact you? So we're in the people business and information business. And I think everybody, you know, whether you're, again, in healthcare sales, like you're in a people business. Don't get it confused that your product or your asset or your fund, like your fund is really made up of assets, but it's backed by people that want to invest in you. So your ability to, and one of the things, you know, just to come full circle, I mean, you're a great operator. And I saw some of the successes you had on some deals that we sold you. I was really impressed with your track record, the turnaround, what you did, but you're a great person. You're a great person to work with. I see how you treat sellers. I see how you treat your staff, how you treat us as brokers, you know, as we're working for you, but you really do a great job of treating people as your equal, you know, even though you're superior, you know, and,
I don't know about that.
Yeah. You're very humble, but, you know, that's what really was impressive is that you're creating a ton of value. And one of the reasons why, I decided to invest with you and invest in, just to be clear, to invest in your funds 2 and 3, I saw a ton of value. And, you know, personally, the returns have been unbelievable. Cash on cash has been robust. And then you're handing out these negative K-1s because you're taking care of the accelerated depreciation. So you're offsetting all the cash flow with some tax shield benefits. It's a great investment. So, you know, just to come full circle, I think, you know, having good credibility, having a track record of success, being hands-on with your assets, with your deals is really critical. I think that's what's separating people from the haves and the have-nots in terms of good operators.
First off, I appreciate everything you're saying. I'm honored to be your partner. I'm very happy that and humbled that you invested in us and you saw that value, and it's been fruitful for you and your family. That's the intent here at Crystal View, is to drive returns for investors, and creating friendships in the process is a wonderful byproduct. But I think you bring up something that's pretty important in this industry, because I'm always astonished by those owners that don't operate their own community. And I think there's probably a striking difference in from a returns perspective of those hands-on owner operators versus those groups that buy an asset as a capital allocator and then just kind of flip it off to a third party and hope and pray that that asset is gonna work out the way that they underwrote. And usually it seldom does. This is very hands-on. Things could get away from you very quickly, from my experience. And if you really don't control that process from A to Z, nobody is gonna care about that performance and that asset like an owner is. And from our standpoint, it's just imperative to operate it from the time you buy it until the time you sell it and everywhere in between. But from your perspective as a broker, and I know you may not get involved in returns, but how much of a difference can you decipher between an owner operator versus an owner who outsources operations to a third party?
Yeah, I think to back up, I think the return profiles from the get-go of the two groups you're talking about are just different. And, you know, I think we talk about like, how would I find a good deal for you versus, you know, maybe somebody next to you? And it's what's your capital stack look like? What is your return profile? Are you, you know, Matt, are you cash on cash? I'm just rhetorically saying this, but sure. You're cash on cash focused. Other groups are saying, you know what, we're not day one cap rate folks. We're IRR focused. It's all about unpacking what the return profile is from day one. What's the goal of the asset, the acquisition? Is it a lifetime hold where this is, we're going to buy it one time, we're going to hold it for forever. It's a legacy asset. It's a, core plus, core fund asset. Is it more opportunistic? I mean, all those things come into play with where you're going with owner and operations, because it starts going, you know, you go into an asset. We talked about, you know, how you'd approach a rent-controlled asset. What's our return profile? Can we hit our thresholds? So it's understanding, as a broker, my job is really to understand what are those metrics that you're focused on And can this asset, if we get into this asset, we sell you this deal, can you achieve it? And so once you start there, and then also understand, you know, are you trying to kick into a Fannie and Freddie loan? Is this CMBS debt? Are you going to go with a local bank? Is it a life co, et cetera? So I think understanding equity and debt from a buyer's perspective, day one, is the best way to marry up the asset to the buyer. Not understanding those things or having a lack thereof, understanding of those things is where I'm wasting your time. I'm showing you deals that are, you know, there's no rents are maxed, occupancies 100%. I'm wasting your time. And we've had time and opportunity to learn that about each other. But I think really just fleshing that out. And one of the best ways to really do that too is, what's the last thing you bought? I would love to hear it too, just because I think it'd be good for the audience. But, you know, I'd love to hear, like, what's the last thing you bought? Because that's a telling story of, maybe it's an outlier, maybe it was a one-off, but more than likely, when we look back at your track record, probably what you're going to buy more of. So, I mean, what's the last thing you guys bought? Tell us a little bit about it. And maybe what's the return profile look like? Where are we going with the asset? Why'd you buy it?
Yeah. Well, you want me to answer?
Oh, yeah. I want to hear this. I'm putting you on the spot here. I'm going to make you happy today. Yeah, yeah. I think it'd be interesting for the audience too, because I think, you know, you have a lot of knowledge to share. So, I mean, like, how you're sizing things up, why you're buying what you're buying, I think is really insightful for myself and the audience.
Yeah, well, I'd be happy to. The last deal we bought was in Florence, South Carolina. Not a very large community, but really interesting. Check the box of a mom and pop owner operator in a major way. It was an inheritance deal. Rents were literally half the market. So you've got that low hanging fruit. And it was a very strong market to sell homes. We have 120 sites here, and we've got a decent amount of vacancy, not much, but a decent amount. And I think you know this community because the actual lots themselves are almost half-acre sites. We might be able to reconfigure how these homes sit on these sites and double our footprint. It's about 120 sites. We may be able to go up to 200+, depending how we reconfigure this. Most compelling thing, of course, most importantly as an investor, is the basis. I mean, we picked this thing up for about $40,000 a pad. A broker actually told me there was a trade recently in the market for about 100 a pad, which I can't fathom. So, you know, picking it up at that type of basis with that type of upside with conservative underwriting, checked all the boxes, and obviously we leapt right in. Now, you being a broker might be listening to this going, wow, this is fantastic as an investor, but as a broker, how the hell am I going to find that? So I'm not saying it has to be that sweet, but yeah. You asked the question, so I gave you the answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, I think there's always shades of things, right? So it's upside can mean many different things. It can take on many different shapes and colors. And so whether it is maybe reconfiguring some lots, maybe it is through rent growth, maybe it is through fill, maybe value can be created day one because you bought it for less than what it's probably worth on an open market, right? So there's different ways you can create value, and sometimes you create it just by buying it, right? So
sure.
Kudos to you on that one, and we'll be looking for more opportunities where you could buy below market.
Wonderful. Give me hopefully I'm the first guy on your list.
Let's put your phone number down in the comments below. I'll call you.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're coming to a close. Let me ask one last question. Where do you view the industry 10 years from now?
Certainly more consolidated than it is now. You know, I talked about alternatives before. There's been sort of an alternative subset of groups saying, well, the 200 place community is kind of gobbled up. Let's just get a bunch of smaller ones. Let's aggregate those for scale in an MSA. So I think you're going to continue to see consolidation where it was more on 200 plus sites and above. Now you're seeing it like, hey, let's create a portfolio of smaller in total size of communities, number of lots. Let's get a bunch of those. Let's create some scale that way and other ways. And again, we're going to just continue to see the consolidation of the industry going from mom and pops up to private investors like yourself and other private equity firms and institutional investors. We're just going to keep consolidating. And then I think, again, you're going to see in some of these, whether I'm not speaking for you, but funds, that the life of those funds are going to eventually come to an end, and you're going to see, you know, them being repackaged together and spun off to other groups. Whether, you know, for you, you're creating value. So once you're done creating value, you're probably package them up and spin them off to another group that's maybe looking for more stabilized assets, and on it will go. But I think that's really where we'll see it. You know, I would love to sit here and tell you, I hope we find a way to create more communities. I don't think we will. There'll be fewer communities in 10 years than there is today. And I think, you know, the great thing about all real estate is that we're going to have another cycle. We're going to have another run up and continually, you know, a decline as well. So in those market rises and falls, we'll have a lot of opportunities as well. And probably some good stories. I hope that communities throughout the country, as cities and municipalities, want to work with operators like you and like others that are good operators that want to, you know, I hear too many stories, whether it be institutional or mom and pop, where, you know, they've got room for two more sites and they just want one or two more sites. And the process through the local town is just so arduous and they give them such a hard time. I would love to hear about more success stories and the service and the good that our industry provides, and hope that more people lean into that and give people like you and other owners the leeway to create more opportunities for citizens of these communities throughout the country. So yeah, that's my hope. I'm, you know, maybe it's wishful thinking, but that's where I hope we go.
Well, I think very insightful. I would align with a lot of what you're saying there in terms of the consolidation. And I would hope also that, you know, this industry and those operators that are really adding value and providing affordable housing get a little decent recognition, a little acknowledgement, and a little help from local municipalities to continue their business plan, because it is to the best interest of the community and the nation at large. Back to your point of mission critical, and I'm honored to be a part of it. And blessed to be a part of it, and I'm honored to do it with you as a friend, colleague, and investor. So I've enjoyed the run, and I think we've got a lot longer way to go together. So I appreciate you being here with me, my friend.
Yeah, thanks for the relationship. Thanks for everything, Matt. Appreciate you having me on, and hopefully I was helpful to some of your audience today.
Very helpful. I learned a lot. I'm sure the audience did as well. And by the way, we will put your information at the end of this podcast for anybody who is thinking of buying or selling a community, so that they could go to the best broker in the business and get the best service out there, because I certainly have over the years.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it, Matt.
Thanks, Michael. Have a great day.
Talk to you soon. You too. Bye-bye.